May it please the court. My name is Ned Jekyll, attorney registration 10952, and I represent the appellant, Corey Wagner. Your Honors, I want to begin my argument from a very fundamental starting point. It's a fundamental principle of our system of criminal justice, indeed of our system of trial by jury, that after presentation of the evidence, that the jury will reach a proper and reasoned verdict by applying the law to the facts. This fundamental assumption, in turn, turns on another assumption, a set of assumptions. First, an assumption that the jury will be given all of the law it needs in order to reach a proper verdict. It also assumes that the jury will not be misled or be confused by given instructions that have no bearing on the case, that are inopposite to the case. And to a lesser extent, also, that counsel will not misstate the law in its argument to the jury. In this case, due to multiple errors, four of the instructional variety, one of a misstatement by the prosecutor, Mr. Wagner was not afforded that very fundamental principle of our system of trial by jury. Because time is limited, I'm going to try to focus on just one of those errors, but first I just want to summarize those errors for the court. First, the court failed to give two instructions, both tendered by Mr. Wagner, both instructions that under Colorado law he was entitled to. And I refer here to the multiple assailants instruction, and secondly to an instruction on intoxication, because there was evidence of both in this case. There was evidence that the unlawful force that Mr. Wagner was defending against involved multiple assailants. Secondly, there was also evidence of intoxication in this case.
On the evidence of intoxication, I understand there's evidence that Mr. Wagner had been drinking fairly heavily before the party. Is there any evidence in the record of the effect that drinking had on him? Because as I understand the case law and the statutes, intoxication talks not only just about amount, but effect of consumption of alcohol.
With respect to that, Your Honor, other than that his actions perhaps speak for themselves, there's not a great deal of observation of him. We're talking here in this case about a chaotic scene, a party with 60 people and so on and so forth. Mr. Wagner is not, prior to this incident, is more of an outsider to this group and so on and so forth.
How's that bear on whether there's evidence of intoxication?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm a little...
I'm sorry too, counsel. How does that bear on whether there was evidence of intoxication, that is, not only amount of alcohol, but effect of the alcohol consumed?
Yes. Well, my understanding of the case law is that with respect to evidence of intoxication, as with respect to evidence of any particular defense, only a scintilla of evidence is required prior to the instruction to be given. I think what Your Honor is getting to is really a question that is properly presented to the jury and for jury argument.
What was the scintilla of evidence of effect of the alcohol consumed? What scintilla evidence can you point to give us that there was a scintilla of evidence presented on the effect of the alcohol?
Yes. Approximately 6 hours after his arrest, after this incident, Mr. Wagner was interviewed by a detective. He not only stated as to copious amounts of alcohol and marijuana that he had consumed, but he also stated, I believe, that his mind, and the defendant, I believe, also testified to this, that his mind, Mr. Wagner said that his mind was crazy, that he doesn't remember a whole lot about what happened. He only recalled flashes of things. These are all symptoms, at least that I've come to recognize through my practice, is sort of consistent with almost an alcoholic blackout sort of state.
And did you say he testified to that, or was that just a self-serving statement?
That is evidence that was in the record based on his interview with a detective.
Well, can I ask you, I'm sorry, Judge. Mr. Jekyll, how do you distinguish on this point the Brown case? Can you hear me okay? The Supreme Court's decision in Brown, which as I read it says, a defendant's uncorroborated testimony that I was drunk back then is not enough to get the voluntary intoxication instruction. Because I think we're agreeing, I think there was evidence, as you say, that the defendant here did say, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I drank a lot. But that's, I think that's it. I don't think anybody, if I recall, anybody else testified to his state of mind at the time. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, first off, I would say that, that Mr. Wagner's statement is somewhat corroborated by the testimony of Mr. Lucero, who basically corroborated their itinerary of having gone to clubs, of having gone to a hotel party, so on and so forth. Secondly, I think Brown is of really limited applicability here. It's a case that really deals more with inconsistent defenses. As I pointed out in the brief, Brown is a situation where the defendant denies that he committed the act that was the basis for the crime. That's not the situation here. Mr. Wagner was there. There's no dispute about who fired the bullet, what happened here at the party. I did look at Brown the other day, and I'd also sort of, not to be critical of the Supreme Court, but if you read Justice Coates's dissent in that, he very much disagrees with that particular analysis as to what a defendant is entitled to when the defendant puts on this type of evidence of intoxication.
Can I shift gears on you, Mr. Jekyll, and ask you on the multiple assailant instruction?
Yes.
I know the parties have cited Jones in their briefs. You know, in Jones, part of the problem was the judge, as I recall, remember it, the trial judge said, you're not entitled to this instruction. And so it was a pretty strong case and said, no, you are. Here, was there anything that prevented Mr. Wagner from arguing that there were multiple, he was facing multiple assailants? I don't think there was an instruction that said he couldn't. Do you understand what I'm asking you?
Right, right. You know, my position on this is that exactly reverses self-defense law as it's presented in Colorado, and that Colorado law isn't that you are prohibited from, excuse me, that it's okay if you're not prohibited from arguing multiple assailants, but rather once there is evidence of multiple assailants, that you are in fact entitled to that instruction and for the jury to be instructed accordingly. To the extent that his right to argue multiple assailants, or that perhaps the jury wasn't given a clear picture of that, besides the fact that they were not given the instruction, if you look at the self-defense instruction that was given, there are several clauses, not the deadly force clause, but the clauses that immediately follow. The provocation clause, I believe there's also initial aggressor clause. Both, again, the same sort of problem that was presented in Jones, where it refers to a single person, the person who was obviously the alleged victim of the crime. So it did constrict him in that respect. I agree with counsel that defense counsel made the argument. Of course, argument to the jury is not legal instruction. In fact, the jury is told as much in the stock instruction, the very first instruction they're given in a case, that argument is not the law.
Now, there are cases, I think, that say, If the jury is told you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, or there was one involving an apparent necessity instruction that kind of got to that, that would be okay even without the multiple assailant instruction, correct?
Well, not exactly. Judge Graham's opinion in Riley, for example, underscores that Jones stands for the principle that a defendant is entitled to this instruction. Now, the difference between this case and Riley is that in Riley, there was an apparent necessity instruction given, directing the jury to, in a slightly more indirect way, consider the totality of the circumstances involved. Here, that instruction was not given. In fact, although I didn't raise it, of course, because of Beckett, it seemed like not a worthwhile issue, and I was running up against a page limitation, we also tendered an apparent necessity instruction in this case. That was another instruction that was not given by the court. So we didn't have that instruction in this case, the kind of instruction that perhaps made the error harmless in Riley means the error is not harmless here.
All right, so I want to make sure I understand. Mr. Jekyll, what you're saying is you're entitled here on the facts of multiple assailant instruction, or Mr. Wagner was, and there's nothing else that would have directed the jury to consider multiple assailants like an apparent necessity instruction, and that shows that the error here was not harmless. That's your argument?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So can I ask about the make my day instruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
isn't the problem here that, gee, under our case law, the make my day instruction might have been applicable with respect to Mr. Wagner's claim of self-defense against the occupants of the house? But isn't the problem that it wasn't made clear that it wouldn't be applicable or might not be applicable when considering Mr. Wagner's defense of others, as in trying to defend Mr. Placero? Isn't that the problem, is the court didn't make clear the limitation of that?
That's precisely my point. That's precisely the point I'm trying to make in my brief.
And if we agreed with that, how would the court properly instruct the jury in that situation? What additional comment, statement, instruction would the court have to give to make sure that the jury would not confuse the applicability of those principles?
I think that the instruction would have to be very narrowly tailored to the specifics of the case. I think it's completely an opposite here, because I don't think Mr. Wagner was charged with any crimes vis-a-vis, well, okay, you're right, I stand corrected. I think it would have to be very narrowly tailored to the specific crime, the specific victim involved, if Mr. Wagner was asserting self-defense with respect to that particular crime. And I believe he was, in fact.
Would it suffice, in your view, if there was just a preparatory clause that said, in analyzing Mr. Wagner's defense of self-defense?
Vis-a-vis ex-victim, alleged victim, something of that sort, yes. And I mean, really, our body of self-defense law really counsels courts to tailor the instructions to the specifics of the individual case. So I think that would be very consistent with existing Colorado case law.
Well, let me ask you this. Assuming that you know, we might be susceptible to that argument, would the error in this instance be prejudicial, and if so, why so?
Yes, I believe the error is extremely prejudicial because it limits his right of self-defense, because when we're talking about the murder charges, we're speaking about the unlawful physical force that's applied against Mr. Lucero. We're not talking about Mr. Wagner. Mr. Lucero has made a lawful entry into the house. There's no reasonable claim that the occupants are applying force to repel his unlawful entry. He's in the house, and he's getting beaten up by multiple people. So the prejudice is that, and in fact, I think it's demonstrated, possibly, depending upon what you read into that jury question, can you have self-defense at the beginning and then lose self-defense, I'm paraphrasing, shortly after entrance? I mean, that could be directed, that could evidence some confusion in the jury's mind that they think Mr. Wagner's entry is unlawful, therefore he may not use the right of self-defense vis-a-vis the force being applied to Mr. Lucero.
I'm not sure that the question would necessarily relate to the issue of defending Mr. Lucero, since it was phrased in terms not of defense of others, but self-defense. Councilman, I don't want to take up any more of your time. We've only got a minute and a half or so.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jekyll. Mr. Kaler.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general at the Colorado Department of Law, and I'm here for the people in this case. As we all know, this is a self-defense deadly force case. I think there's three general principles that should guide the court's decision in this case. In such a case, in order for a defendant's exercise of deadly physical force to be justifiable, it has to be exercised in a reasonable manner, it has to be directed against unlawful force, and the person that, if he's defending himself or if he's defending a third party, as he claimed here, the person he's defending must have been in imminent danger of being killed or suffering great bodily injury.
Let me ask you about that last one. He must in fact have been in imminent danger of being killed or great bodily injury, or
did it reasonably
perception that he was in imminent danger?
Did it reasonably appear to him, Your Honor? And that's the question here. And of course, let me just run through the facts briefly just to make sure we're all on the same page, at least from my point of view. The defendant and his friends crashed a party. They had a pistol with them, which they referred to as a strap. Within minutes of getting to the party, Mr. Lucero tried picking up somebody's girlfriend. And when the boyfriend showed up, within minutes, if that long, they were brawling on the floor. The host and the hostess, who had been having a great time with their friends, grabbed the defendant and grabbed Mr. Madrid and threw them out. And the hostess punched Mr. Wagner as she was doing so. Then the defendant punched her back, knocked her down, sucker punched another woman who happened to be standing at the door, I think breaking her jaw. And then they pulled out the pistol. Mr. Wagner forced his way in, pulled out the pistol. The other invited party guests started running for the back exit. And then the defendant fired once into the back of Mr. Montoya, killing him.
Those undisputed facts, counsel, or those facts you
I think, Mr. Jagel will probably tell me differently. I think those are fairly undisputed. I will say clearly that who started the fight on the sofa, whether it was the boyfriend or whether it was the defendant's friend, I think that's disputed. And I think that actually helps me both ways as far as the trial court needing to provide the jury with guidance concerning with the provocation instruction and the other instructions at issue here.
Mr. Kaler, as I understand the other side's presentation, the shot that killed the victim here was an errant shot that was fired in a chaotic situation for whatever that's worth.
I'm not sure it was errant. I thought the defense was self-defense, which we all usually say it's a defense in the nature of confession and avoidance. I don't think he was arguing that it was unintentional or was negligently or just a misstep. I thought he was arguing that he fired in defense of his friend, Mr. Lucero.
That may be, but not intentionally in shooting at Mr. Lucero's back.
Or Mr. Montoya.
I'm not sure it really matters all that much, because the jury, of course, gets to decide which way it went. I thought the defendant was saying he shot in defense of Mr. Lucero's life.
The reason that I posit that as the other side's version of the facts is I'm having a difficult time understanding where the assailants were and why you would be entitled to a multiple assailants instruction in that factual scenario.
Well, it was, yeah, as Mr. Jekyll said, it was a pretty confused situation. I thought that the theory of defense down below was that Mr. Lucero was getting beaten up by at least one, maybe more people, and that Mr. Wagner's theory of defense was that he was entitled to exercise deadly force on Mr. Lucero's behalf.
Well, and let me ask you, Mr. Kaler, on that point. Let's assume for argument's sake that those facts would establish grounds for multiple assailant instruction. What in the jury instructions here alerted the jurors to the fact that they could consider that there were multiple assailants, beating on Mr. Lucero? I mean, that's the argument, right? There are multiple assailants. As Mr. Jekyll pointed out, other cases, there's something else, whether there's instruction about totality of the circumstances or an apparent necessity instruction here. As he points out, there really wasn't anything else. We've got a bunch of instructions referring to assailants in the singular. What would have alerted the jurors to the fact that they could consider that there were multiple assailants?
Well, the trial court certainly could have given a multiple assailants instruction if it wanted to. It was, the trial courts are given discretion in deciding which instructions to give as long as they're legally applicable.
But doesn't the law say a defendant is entitled to it if the facts support it?
I think my reading of the case law, Your Honor, and I think I put down every multiple assailants jury instruction decision I could find in the cases. The problem arises when either the trial court or somebody tells the jury erroneously that he is not entitled to act in defense of a third party. As you look at the old cases, which are Jones is one, I've forgotten what the other one, the other Supreme Court case, the jury somehow was told the defendant can only act in his own defense and not in defense of a third party, which is obviously an incorrect statement of Colorado law.
I thought the problem with those cases was not defense of others versus self-defense. It was that somehow the instructions led the jury to believe that the defendant's actions had to be measured vis-a-vis a particular person as opposed to other persons?
You may be right, Your Honor. That's not exactly my reading. I'm not sure. You may be right. The question, but here there was no such limitation. I don't think there's any rational way the jury could have thought that the defendant could have acted in his own self-defense, but not in defense of a third party. That was the argument he made without objection from the prosecution or being interrupted by the trial court. And the jury instruction 16, the general self-defense instruction, it told the jury that he could act reasonably, and number two, which is the key one here, had reasonable grounds to believe and did believe that he or another person was in imminent danger of being killed or receiving great bodily injury.
But doesn't also that instruction suggest that the defendant's actions had to be measured vis-a-vis in response to a particular person or victim? It doesn't say other persons. You can defend other persons, but isn't there a suggestion in the self-defense instruction that it may be limited to a response to a person or the victim's actions?
I don't think so. I don't think the exact language of jury instruction number 16, Your Honor, really talks about the person that the force is being exercised against. It talks about exercising deadly physical or exercising force on behalf of someone, and clearly.
How many instructions are there on self-defense? Just one, or there are two or three?
Oh, I don't remember, Your Honor.
One question, Mr. Kaler, you just raised, or a point you made, said how could he not defend against, that he have a right to defend Mr. Lucero when he didn't have a right to defend himself? I mean, I'll posit this and ask for your reaction to it. I mean, one place is the make my day instruction. I mean, here he was, Mr. Wagner was thrown out and came back in. So there is a legitimate argument, I think, as Judge Daly was asking Mr. Jekyll, that it may pertain to him, to Mr. Wagner. That doesn't have anything to do with Mr. Lucero. It strikes me that that would be the distinction you just asked about, but maybe I'm missing it.
Would you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
You said how could it be that Mr. Wagner could be properly defending Mr. Lucero when he couldn't be properly defending himself? It wasn't reasonably acting his own self-defense. Well, the jury could have rejected his argument of self-defense to protect himself because of the make my day instruction.
Right, Your Honor.
But that would not preclude a finding that he was acting reasonably to defend Mr. Lucero.
Right. I don't think anything in the jury instructions would have prohibited the defendant from arguing that, or I think it let him argue that he was acting in defense of Mr. Lucero. There is really no evidence that the defendant, other than getting punched by the hostess, and he wasn't even charged with assaulting her, that he was acting in, that anybody was beating on him. He sucker punched the woman at the door. He pistol whipped the guy and he menaced somebody else. There was nobody moving towards him. And everybody, once he came in with his strap, everybody started running out. It's like the Larson case from this court and like the old Farrell case. When you start shooting people in the back, it's kind of hard, and people are running away from you. It's hard to assert that you're acting in self-defense or defense of a third party. Besides, too, this was I'm not sure if this is a principle of law in places other than in my own personal book on appellate law, but I think looking at the law of self-defense in Colorado and acting reasonably, you cannot take a gun to a fistfight without more. There was just no reason here for the defendant to be shooting people. He could have certainly gone in there, and he had other means of acting reasonably. He could have fired into the ceiling, but people were already running away from him. Nobody was approaching him.
Why did he get a self-defense instruction at all, then? If there was no evidence in which a jury could find that there was any imminent threat.
Well, let's just say I'll be broad-minded, and I'll say there was a scintilla of evidence that he was acting in self-defense, and I think he was enough, because to get a jury instruction, a trial court has to look at whether there's a scintilla of evidence, a very small amount of evidence that could justify the instruction. I think when you talk about what's reasonable, what's based on the whole evidence before the jury and how everybody was acting, it goes towards a harmlessness argument.
If a jury gets an instruction because there's a scintilla of evidence, doesn't the jury get to make the call?
That's right, Your Honor.
Sitting back and say, well, it would have been unreasonable for the jury to actually make the call they got to make.
I'm not sure I was saying that, Your Honor. I'm just saying that there was a scintilla of evidence here to get, justify the jury instruction. But once the jury had this, it's, I'm just saying that it was, there was really no reason, there's really no way the jury could have come to a different conclusion based on the evidence before it.
Why should we give the jury a choice? The answer is, in your view, the jury could not have come up with a different conclusion.
Oh, I don't know. Juries come up with different conclusions all the time.
Well,
they come up with rather...
Why should we give the jury a choice if, as you say, the jury could not have reached a different conclusion?
Oh, that's just because the way things work. I'm not saying we shouldn't give juries choices, Your Honor. I'm just saying that based on the evidence in this case, based on how everybody was acting, it would have been unreasonable for the jury to come to a different conclusion. Of course, juries can act unreasonably. And also, you know, what we're dealing with here is just words on paper or pixels on our screens, computer screens. Juries can, and I'm basing my argument on what I think is reasonable or what I think is clear based on what we read, but juries can look at people testifying live on the stand and say, he says everything right, but it's a big fat lie. And that's what I'm saying. The jury gets to make that call.
The jury does get to make the call, but as I understand your argument, any error has to be harmless because there's only one call the jury could have made. It had to be the one you say it made, as opposed to if it gets to make a call, it could have made a different choice.
Well, I think I'm just arguing what I understand the harmless error standard review to be, Your Honor.
Okay, counsel, I apologize for taking up so much of your time.
Mr. Kaler, if I can ask you, I'm going to shift gears a bit. I'm curious on the provocation instruction. The court, of course, gave it, and it's one of the issues Mr. Jekyll raises. I'm hard-pressed, to be candid with you, to find what evidence supported that instruction in this case, and I think Mr. Jekyll argues it was not harmless because all these things prevented for the jury from considering self-defense. Could you tell me what, I mean, we all agree, I think, provocation requires here that Mr. Wagner did something to provoke a victim to attack him so he can attack the victim back. What evidence was there of that?
Well, I'll say, I don't think we have the jury instruction conference on the record. I think we just have the trial court coming back with the instructions, and it drives me crazy. I realize why trial judges want to give their court reporters a little bit of a break so their fingers don't fall off in the middle of the trial. But
I really have lawyers nuts, I know.
But I really like it when they have it on the record. And I posited one possible, I think there's actually two possible ways that the provocation instruction was appropriate and provided the jury with guidance, because that's what we're talking about in instructional issues. Did the jury need guidance? I'll get really fast. There were two possible provocations. One at the doorway, getting tossed out, getting punched by the hostess. The jury could have thought, well, did the defendant cause her to punch him, and therefore he wasn't entitled to act in self-defense? Secondly, the incident with the defendant's friend trying to pick up the woman, the boyfriend coming there. There was a dispute over who started the fight first. If the jury believed or thought it was possible that the boyfriend, the outraged boyfriend, punched first, the jury would have had an opportunity to determine whether the defendant's friend was had provoked it, and for that proposition, Your Honor.
If the defendant's friend had provoked it, if the friend's act, is that imputable to the defendant or knowledge of that act?
Knowledge, yes. It's not an absolute bar. If you look at the Silva case, which is cited in my brief, but for different points, they talk about how my office had argued that it was an absolute bar. This court said it's not an absolute bar, but it is a factor that can be considered by the jury.
With respect to provocation?
Yes, Your Honor. I've got the red card.
It's all right. I'd like to answer the question.
Okay.
You can hear me.
Let me just think. I just lost my train of thought. We're talking about provocation.
It went to imputation.
Right? Oh, if the defendant, I think the evidence can be read fairly to show that the defendant and his friends went there looking for trouble. They crashed a party. They got there. They got in a fight. Almost immediately, a reasonable jury could wonder whether they had caused the fight, whether they had provoked it, or whether the defendant's friend had provoked it. If the defendant knew that they were there to cause trouble, that would justify a provocation instruction.
Now I understand your point. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Jekyll, I think you got about a minute and a half or so. Minute 22.
Well, then let me be very brief. Mr. Kaler is, of course, correct that we have a very different view of the facts, and I'll just summarize it that way. In terms of people running, shooting people, there's one bullet, there's one gunshot, there's one injury. It's to Mr. Montoya, and there's no evidence that Mr. Montoya is running. There is evidence of that in this chaotic scene that people are trying to get out of the house, but there's no evidence to suggest anything other than Mr. Montoya is engaged in the assault on Mr. Lucero at the time that he is shot. We just can't tell.
He shot in the back, isn't he? Isn't he hit in the back?
That's absolutely correct, Judge.
So does that suggest he's engaged in the fight with Mr. Montero? With Mr. Lucero?
No, it doesn't, because the person that Mr. Montoya is focused on and the person that Mr. Montoya is fighting is Mr. Lucero. According to Mr. Lucero, there are several people hitting him, one of whom I believe is Mr. Montoya. And
where in the record does it show Mr. Montoya was hitting him? Can you tell me that, Mr.?
It shows that he was there are, and I can't give you a record site right now. I'm afraid. I can't come up with it at my fingertips, but there is a record that Anthony Montoya is one of the people who was engaged in this combat. And in terms of factual arguments, I just conclude by saying Mr. Kaler makes an excellent jury argument. I hope the court invites him to argue it to a new jury that's properly instructed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jacob. We thank both counsel for their excellent arguments and excellent briefs, all of which were very helpful to the courts. It's very nice to have such experienced and superb lawyers here. So, as always, we will take the matter under advisement. A written opinion will issue in due course. That